I'm Josh Rushing, filling in for Femi OK, and you're in the stream. Today, the pursuit of nuclear fusion. Many think of it as like the ultimate energy source of the future, right? Virtually unlimited and free of radioactive gas and greenhouse gases. But what will it take to get there? Scientists have been at work on fusion energy for decades, and now they say achieving it may be closer than ever. We'll hear more about the science and what's being done with fusion just after this, but I want to know, what questions do you have? Okay, look at this. See this box over here? There you go. That's YouTube. If you're watching this on YouTube, we have a live producer in there right now waiting to get your questions to me so I can get them to the world's foremost experts on fusion who are joining me now on the big screen. And I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. We're going to start with Tim. Tell us who you are.
Hi, Josh. I'm Tim Luce. I'm the chief scientist for the ITER Project. For those of you who don't know, the ITER Project's the largest effort toward magnetic confinement fusion. It's a consortium of China, European Union, India, Japan, Korea, Russia, and the United States.
Wow. Oh, great. Thanks. All right, Andrew.
Hey, Josh. I'm Andrew Holland, CEO of the Fusion Industry Association. We are the private association representing all of the privately funded fusion companies trying to commercialize fusion power.
All right, great. And Tammy.
Hi, I'm Tammy Ma from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and I work on the National Ignition Facility. We are the world's largest, most energetic laser in the world.
Okay, great. Tammy, I want to begin with you. We have a graphic here. We're going to roll. Can you walk us through what fusion is?
Yeah, absolutely. So fusion is the same reaction that powers the sun. What you're seeing here is what we try to do, which is to fuse deuterium and tritium. They are two isotopes of hydrogen, so heavy hydrogen. And we have to slam that deuterium and tritium atom close enough together such that they fuse. And on the reaction side, you get a helium nucleus coming out and a neutron. And that helium nucleus weighs a little bit less than that deuterium and tritium originally did. So you stick that into Einstein's famous equation, mm-hmm. that differential in mass, you multiply by c squared, the speed of light squared, and that's why you get a huge amount of energy out, and that's the potential of fusion.
Yes, small numbers put into that formula become really large because of the speed of light squared. It's just a huge number, right?
That is exactly right. Yep.
But currently, guys, this exists only theoretically, right?
No, not really,
actually,
because we...
This would be the first of many things I get wrong. Please set us right.
At least on the magnetic side, we've been making fusion for a long time. The challenge is the scientific feasibility, making fusion give us more energy back than we put in.
Right.
And that's the frontier we're striving for now. I'll give it back to Tammy. She was going to also make a comment along the same lines, I suspect.
Well, it's
Thanks
probably a good time,
yet.
Tammy. Let me throw this out here, because you guys just had a breakthrough out there, right? And we can look at my computer and see the story about it. Fusion breakthrough at the brink of fusion ignition at the National Ignition Facility, where you're sitting, Tammy. What was the breakthrough?
Yeah, so the breakthrough was we got almost 70% of the way to getting more energy out than we put in with the lasers. And what we were also able to accomplish was what we call a burning plasma in fusion. So that little spark that we started was enough to actually get, you know, your wood burning and in a regime that is very interesting and can rapidly increase to much more fusion reactions.
And this has been done before, but you got better results this time. Is that right? And how much better results? Like, what? How big of a step forward is this?
That's a great question. We've been doing fusion with lasers here for quite a while. This particular result was the best that we've ever had. It was a 25x improvement over where we were a year ago. This was the first time we actually really started to burn a significant portion of the fusion fuel.
Great. We're going to bring in a video comment. This is from Derek Sutherland. He's the CEO of CTF Fusion. Check it out.
Fusion is a nuclear process in which light elements like hydrogen are fused together at very high temperatures into heavier elements like helium, releasing a lot of energy in the process via E equals MC squared. Unlike fission, fusion has zero risk of meltdowns and no long-lived radioactive waste as part of the process. Over the past decades, the worldwide scientific community have built the foundations for realizing fusion power plants, and now there's a burgeoning private industry building upon these foundations, aiming to commercialize this technology in the 2030s. We are at the precipice of realizing this energy source after decades of scientific R&D, and we'll deploy this to the world with firm, affordable, and safe carbon-free power.
So, Andrew, can you jump in on this? Because Tammy represents the U.S. government's efforts here. And what Derek's talking about, it sounds like the kind of commercial prospects. And I know you represent that side in this conversation, right?
That's right. Derek said it very well. He's one of the CEOs of my member company, so I couldn't have said it better myself.
Perfect.
So the difference is the new thing that's coming is in the private sector. We are bringing in private dollars for the first time into this effort to commercialize fusion power. Mm-hmm. For a long time, 60 plus years, there's been investment by government scientists and important research done into fusion energy. And, you know, they created a whole new area of physics, plasma science. And we've seen really important breakthroughs and movement towards commercialization. So the 2020s now are the era where we move from the lab and into the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And we just put out a survey of our members and other private fusion companies around the world, looking at how much money is invested and the timescales. And Derek's right, the consensus timescale is that we're going to get the first fusion energy onto the grid in the 2030s or earlier. That's our goals. So that's what we're working towards. And we're bringing in, importantly, a lot of new private dollars, private venture capital-backed investment that is really making a difference in the advances towards fusion energy. Just when we put out this survey about 6 weeks ago, and we tallied up about $1.9 billion. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've seen $2.4 billion more come into our private companies. Hmm. So just the acceleration that's happening here will lead to an acceleration of results and building real experiments that will show that this is possible and that we're on the pathway towards commercial fusion energy.
Hey, Tim, can you jump in here? I'm curious two things off the bat. One, we've heard the U.S. government lab perspective and a private sector perspective. Bring us up, like, internationally. We have a large international audience. What does this mean for the world? And I'm also curious, Tammy was talking about using the lasers to push this fusion. You're looking at a different technology with super strong magnets. Can you walk me through that a little bit?
Okay, so two aspects. Let me start with the second one you mentioned. In our case, we use magnets because the plasma is electrically charged. So the particles are tied to the magnetic field, and if we make a magnetic field, well, they're all this way, they connect to each other. So the particles in principle can't escape, and we can make the high temperatures we need for fusion to go. Tammy alluded to it by saying we have to push them together rather aggressively. We need 100 million degrees Celsius to make the fusion reactions go. How do you make a temperature that high? Well, you put in energy, but you need insulation, and there's two ways to get that insulation, either a strong magnetic field or a bigger device. So we use superconducting magnets. We use the conventional superconducting technology because that was available when the project started. What the industry is looking at are advances on that, either to go to higher field or to magnets of the same type that operate at higher temperature, which reduces the need for the rest of the plant. In terms of the international perspective, the U.S., Russia, Europe, and Japan have been involved in the project for a long time. One of the exciting things that happened at the beginning of the ITER organization's formation was that China, India, and Korea also joined. So we have people from around the world. Why would they invest? In some cases, 10% of the value of the project, they get 100% of the results. And so they can bring that back then after ITER, and ITER's mission is to demonstrate the scientific and technical feasibility of fusion as an energy device. they can then go to the next step. So we'll prove scientific feasibility. We'll start on technical feasibility, but there's another frontier, which is economic feasibility. Hmm. And that will take a significant technological development beyond what we can do here at ITER.
Thanks, Tim. Hey, Tammy, I want to throw a handful of real quick questions at you. And these are from our YouTube audience watching right now. All right. This one says, it seems like the biggest concern with fusion safety would be everyday tritium escape into the environment. Does that risk have any comparison to the neighborhood environmental effects of fossil plants? Going down, here's another one about, let's see, this is from Ariska Flynn. How much will fusion cost compared to nuclear? Do we have any nuclear waste from fusion energy like fission energy? Do we have raw material readily available? Well, let's start with that. Second, see where we go.
Go ahead, Tammy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to answer those questions in reverse order.
Okay.
First of all, one of the advantages of fusion is we don't expect there to be any high-level nuclear waste. And so you don't have to worry about burying, you know, your remaining waste somewhere in a mountain or something and letting it decay over time. We don't have to worry about that because, like in that figure that Josh showed, the only output that we have is helium and then energetic neutrons. In terms of tritium, I'll let one of my other colleagues answer that question. But we do expect that fusion would be much, much safer than fission, even though it is still a nuclear reaction that we're talking about. But it's we will have to go work with our nuclear regulatory agencies and make sure that we pass through all the regulations clearly. But we also hope to work with the community and make sure that they feel comfortable and safe to have a fusion reactor in their backyard.
Great. And Andrew, you're going to jump in with the tritium.
Yeah, on the regulatory front with tritium, we are deeply involved with the regulators here in figuring out how fusion power plants are going to be operated safely and appropriately. And what we'd say about that is that a fusion power plant will look largely like existing medical isotope facilities, accelerators that exist in downtowns all around the country. These are not going to be, you know, a large setback facility like a nuclear power plant where there's, you know, a threat of a catastrophic meltdown or anything like that. And then there's also a question about costs. And, you know, we're still probably a decade or so out here, so it's difficult to estimate costs, but there's been a couple of cost estimates put out by ARPA-E and others, and the targets are in the range of 4 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour, which is roughly the cost of natural gas. So we know that the electricity marketplace in the United States especially is extremely competitive. We have to make sure that we're producing electricity because, you know, while we're excited about producing fusion energy, what we're actually selling is just electrons, just like you get out of the wall plug anywhere else in the world. So you got to be competitive.
Hey, I read somewhere that like a few grams of water through fusion could produce as much energy as 8 tons of oil. Is that correct?
Yep, that's what our PR says. It's a gram, actually. A gram of fully burned deuterium tritium will give you 8 tons of the equivalent of 8 tons of oil burning.
Tim, that sounds too good to be true. Like, what's the catch, huh?
We got to go do it. That's the catch.
Okay, if it's possible, it's a catch. Or how about is any country in the world or any entity in the world responsible enough to really hold and harness the power of the sun?
Well, to me, the intrinsic safety is what we've talked about already. If you look at like a fission plant, which is what is conventional nuclear power now, after it's been refueled, it has a year's worth of fuel in it. A fusion device, at least a magnetic fusion device, which has the largest fuel capacity, will have 1 second or a few seconds worth of fuel in it. This is why it's intrinsically safe in terms of runaway. We talk about not having meltdown and such. There's just no energy there for it to take to melt down. So that part we're highly confident in because it's there by design. So going back to the issue of tritium safety, it's an industrial standard. Now, there is, in the United States at least, tritium handling to do all sorts of different industrial uses. So it's a well-known process to follow, track, and confine tritium in an industrial-type plant safely. There's no additional risk coming from the nuclear fusion part of it. We're just burning the fuel, basically.
Yeah, but Tammy, a number of our viewers are concerned, and here's one on in YouTube, Jay Hanishda. Is it possible to be weaponized?
Hi, Jay. Oh, that's a good question. We do produce enormous energy densities in our reactions. However, like Tim was alluding to, these are very tiny reactions that actually occur, utilizing very small amounts of fuel. And so while we can achieve conditions that are incredibly extreme and study those, actually, it is not straightforward to actually weaponize this.
Hey, can I?
Yeah.
Go ahead, jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to jump in.
One thing I would say is,
you know, sometimes. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Sorry, Andrew. One thing I would say is, before any of us were born, this was the fear, and fusion research was classified. And in the 1950s already, it was very clear that it couldn't be easily used to develop any kind of weapons. And in fact, everything, the ITER agreement has explicitly in it that we're doing all this for peaceful purposes. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea that what we're doing in terms of fusion energy technology can be weaponized is not a reasonable concern at this point.
Fair
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, we've been done wrong by Hollywood. Both Batman and Spider-Man have fusion reactors that are turned into weapons, and that's just not the way it works and not the way it could work. Of course, you know, fusion is a part of the hydrogen bomb, but that is a completely separate way of doing it and just not something that is there. For our commercial companies, we think that this regulatory pathway and the intrinsic safety of fusion make it uniquely capable of global adoption. You asked who is responsible for this globally. You know, the great part is that it can be just the private sector ultimately that builds and pushes these all around the world from, you know, places that you'd never think to build a nuclear power plant. You'd never want to build a nuclear power plant in, you know, say Iraq or something like that. But there's no reason that you couldn't put a fusion power plant there. It's really important because this allows us to break kind of the geopolitics of energy, the linkage between who has oil, who has gas, and the geopolitical power that goes along with that. It instead becomes the scale of your technology is the power of your economy.
Hey, I want to jump over to Tokyo right now, where we have another comment from someone in our community. It's in Kyoto. Shotaro Takada. He's a co-founder and chief strategist of Kyoto Fusioneering.
Mm-hmm. A faster path for commercialization for fusion energy has just opened up due to recent technological innovations. And these innovations allow more advanced and compact fusion power plants to be constructed within the next 10, 15 years. So now investors like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos are starting to see fusion as a realistic, clean energy alternative. And now get this. Globally, private fusion companies have raised well over $4 billion, and 80% of these companies believe they can achieve fusion energy by 2030s.
So I want to talk about the timeline he mentioned right at the end of that, and I'm going to show our audience my computer. There's an article that says the Theranos trial shows us why we should be suspicious of nuclear fusion. And I said nuclear like a Texan there, didn't I? But down in here, it's so hard to get out, the Texan in me. But there's a timeline here. It says Tokamak Energy says working power plant connected to the grid by 2030. General Fusion says an operating power plant by 2025. Hellion Energy says they'll do it in 2024. First Light Fusion says 2024. Zap Energy says 2023. 2023 is like 13 months away, 14 months away. Andrew, are these realistic timelines?
Yeah, so let's be clear here that these are timelines for demonstrating the science of fusion in a break-even way. This is not timelines for getting a power plant onto the grid, other than that the one that, that said 2030. And, you know, I think that there is a pathway towards a very accelerated time frame getting there in the 2030s or the late 2020s. But, you know, I worry about the I read this article this morning, too. And, you know, the author really compiles a lot of things that are not really clear and, you know, takes things out of context. And it doesn't pass muster to me as something that is a serious article or something we should worry about. And, you know, the Theranos comparison is problematic for me, too, because that was one company that was fraudulent. Mm-hmm. And our member companies, there's 26 companies all working hard. And, you know, they're probably not all going to make it. And they're probably not all going to be the commercial fusion leader. But when you've got 26 shots on goal, I like those odds. Mm.
All right, I'm going to bring in another comment. This is from Jane Hoskis. She's a president and co-founder of Energy for the Common Good. It's a U.S. nonprofit that advocates for fusion energy.
We celebrate all the global private and public fusion development going on because this is a very exciting moment in fusion and in clean energy. For instance, two companies in the U.S. have raised $4 billion in the last 2 months. This equals 10% of our total fusion research funding since 1951. These are important milestones, but adoption of a new energy source requires more than science and engineering. We need stakeholders who understand the benefits and risks for this new partner in clean energy. And this kind of development in public education requires its own funding.
Andrew, I think that's what you were just touching on, how Hollywood has done us wrong. What is she talking about with the kind of education that stakeholders need for this, I guess, for everyone to understand this and accept it, right?
She's totally right. It's acceptance. It's, you know, believing in the legitimacy of fusion and, you know, getting people to know that this is something that will be safe, sustainable and achievable for all. And so we need allies. Mm-hmm. We need it to be not just the three of us who are fusioneers. I'm not a fusion scientist, but the other two on this panel are. Mm-hmm. We need environmental groups to be coming out and supporting us. We need all of these other allies. You know, we've got to work together. And Jane is a great leader in this, another affiliate member of ours as well. So,
hey, Tammy, talk me through what's going to happen next. When's your next big experiment? What are the next big breakthroughs that we should be looking for?
Yeah, sure. So what we're trying to do now is repeat our shot to make sure we understand the variability that we might have in our implosions and make sure we understand the sensitivities to different engineering features or parameters of the laser that we use to shoot the capsule. And then going forward, the next big breakthrough for us will be if we can demonstrate more energy out than we put in with the laser. That's the definition of ignition. And we do expect that to happen over the next few years. And then after that, you want to demonstrate even more energy coming out and then working on the technologies that will make inertial fusion energy a possibility.
And to do that, you're using the world's largest laser. Is that right? How big of a deal is it for you to even conduct one of these experiments? Is it something you can do, you know, daily or like it takes a while to like set this thing up and run it in a heartbeat?
It takes a while. We have a team of several hundred people right now, everything from laser physicists to material scientists to computer scientists. And we also have to run simulations on some of the largest supercomputers in the world to understand the complex physics.
Will the next big breakthrough come from Livermore or should we, like who else out there is on this?
In terms of laser fusion?
Yeah, let Tim jump in.
Sorry, David.
How about from the magnetic side?
Please do.
Yeah, so our timeline is 2025 to demonstrate the first plasma in our tokamak device. So great. To demonstrate that the construction is done properly. And then targeting, we won't use deuterium tritium immediately because we need to practice to make sure everything is right. And that's scheduled for 2035. Starting then, we'll do experiments that lead to energy multiplication of 10. So 10 times the output power that we put in at 500 megawatts
hey, Tim,
is our target.
That sounds amazing, but I got to wrap it there because it's the end of the show. Thanks, Tim, Tammy, Andrew, for coming on and for our audience for being there. Next time, we'll see you in the future.